Maybe go see if Walt can take him for a few minutes. All right. I'm gonna go. You're taking the Mustang? You're taking the Mustang? Hey.
Good morning.
Morning, Barb. Good morning, everyone. I see a few people still joining. Let me give them just a couple more seconds here.
Just testing, Tanya, can you hear me?
I can, yep. Can you hear me?
Thank you. Yep.
Okay. Okay. Still a couple of people joining, but I think I'll get us started. We do have a pretty packed agenda this morning. First of all, thank you all for attending. I know this is less than ideal to have a meeting of this size in this format, but I think we've navigated Zoom for the past few weeks and been doing well with it, so I appreciate your patience. If there's questions along the way, if you could please put them in the chat box, that'll help me try to take them one at a time. Otherwise, we'll kind of open up for questions at the end. I do need to take attendance this morning. If your name is in your box on Zoom, there's no need for you to let us know who you are. I think the question is about the phone numbers that are calling in. So I'm going to call out the phone number, and if you could please unmute and tell us who you are and what agency you're from, that way we have an accurate record for attendance this morning. So the first number I have is 989-837-8350.
Jenny Ireland. Jenny Ireland, PAO.
Thanks, Jenny. The second number I have is 248-802-8109. If you could unmute and tell us who you are and what agency you're from. Okay, let's go to the next one, 989-289-1107.
I didn't hear the first phone number, so I didn't know if that was me.
Okay, who is speaking, please?
Peg Schaefer.
Okay. 989-429-2509. May have been a repeat. Numbers keep popping around on me on the screen. I apologize, you guys, if I repeat something. 989-313-5340. Hearing nothing. 231-580-5204. Okay, 989-621-2624.
Hey, Tanya, this is Janelle from UM. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, my number was called out, but I think what happens is people don't know how to unmute when they're on the call-in. So if you guys need to unmute it, star six, it says it once at the beginning and then it doesn't repeat. So if you need to unmute, just star six and then star six again. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. How about we just do this? Anybody who's just calling in, if you could please take a second and introduce yourself and what agency you're from.
Stephanie Riley, Valley Residential Services.
Todd Olivier. Todd Olivier from SendCare.
Paige Miss with Centria Autism Services.
Kent Vanderloon, McBride Quality Care.
Anybody? Go ahead.
Michelle Young, Listening Ear.
Anybody else just calling in with a phone number in the screen instead of a name? Okay. All right, let's get started. I do have a couple announcements this morning. I think, is Chris Stableford with us this morning? Oh, I think you're muted, Chris. I'll unmute you. There you go. You're unmuted.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, thanks, everybody. Hello. The announcement that I had is to alert providers so you can alert your staff about a couple of things that the Rights Office has investigated that have been looked at as neglect class 3. And just to remind you of the criteria for neglect class 3, the questions would be, did a particular thing happen? If yes, was that a violation of a standard of care? If yes, was the standard of care, the second one would be, if yes, was there a standard of care? The third question would be, if yes, was the standard of care followed? And the fourth question would be, if no, was a person at risk or placed at risk? And the two scenarios that have been looked at as neglect class 3 that we thought you would want to be made aware of would be staff texting while they're driving and staff failing to follow precautions associated with COVID-19. So just a heads up, anyone who's had my staff do investigations about that is aware, but I wanted to make sure that everyone was and field any questions that you might have.
Any questions regarding that? Okay, thanks, Chris.
Oh, I had a question. This is Stephanie Riley.
Okay, Stephanie, go ahead.
When you mean precautions, are you also talking about social distancing or like how, what precautions exactly are you meaning?
I suppose it could be anything that someone files a complaint about, but what we would be looking at would be what the provider said staff are supposed to do, what precautions staff are supposed to observe to minimize the chance that COVID-19 could spread.
Okay.
Any other questions for Chris in that regard?
Jane is on the call as well and can respond.
Okay. All right. Another announcement that I have is regarding licensing, and I'm not sure that everybody has been notified if you're in a licensed residential setting. But licensing has announced that you can now defer fingerprinting of new staff until 10 days after the lifting of the executive order, but you're still urged to do so as soon as possible. The second announcement from licensing is that you are required to report any staff or resident who is positive COVID-19 to a website, and that will be included. I could read it off here, but I think it's better just to send it in the minutes. It's long and lengthy. So we'll have that link in the minutes for you after the meeting. Also, licensing does have an FAQ document on their website, and I'll provide the link for that after the meeting as well in the minutes. Is there any questions in regards to those three items? Okay, we'll move along then to the number three, state of the agency, John. There you go.
All set? Can you hear
yep.
me?
Yep.
All right. Good morning, everyone. It's always a pleasure to have the opportunity to share the state of the agency with community partners. I want to open by sharing our deepest appreciation to Chris Stableford, who you just heard from, our rights officer, who, after 31 years of service, will be retiring this month. So I don't know if you know that, if you can clap this way, or get involved in showing your appreciation. Thanks, Kent. If we get the whole house clapping, that would be awesome. This is a remarkable demonstration of a lifelong commitment to the cause of assuring appropriate mental health supports and services. So over these many years, Chris has served as human resources trainer, a training representative, rights advisor, and for the last 13 years, she has served as our rights officer, leading the rights team. So Chris, we truly appreciate, I'm looking at you over here, Truly appreciate all the great things that you have done and your leadership. Chris's successor is Jane Gilmore, who's also on the call. And Jane has a great history with the Rights Office and the Provider Network. And so we wish Chris a great retirement, and we welcome Jane to her new role. So thank you. Appreciate you very much. I want to thank you all for your resolve to work with us on challenges and the frequent change. We are moving forward as we increase an understanding of our world as we now know it, doing the best we can with what resources we can secure for the greater good of persons served, those who provide and support those services, and all their loved ones. CMHCM and the Provider Network have risen to the challenge to assure community needs are being met while tirelessly staying on guard to keep COVID-19 in check. We are ever grateful for staff on the front lines who are shouldering the stress of the threat of coronavirus on top of the challenges of the usual work routines. They truly are heroes in behavioral health care. I want to tell you that the report of Central Michigan providers coming together to share resources was shared by me with state leaders who were delighted to hear some good news. We hope that the agency is, as well, reflecting that same spirit in our relationship with you, and that you feel we are providing the supports and information you need to keep people safe and healthy. And so hopefully today we'll continue that. There are many people behind the scenes at CMH and in the Provider Network who have performed Herculean feats to assure appropriate services are delivered. In March, CMHCM moved about 90% of its staff to telework arrangements in the span of a week. My hope is that the Provider Network can't tell the difference other than the reduced in-person activity. Our case management contacts were the highest so far this year during that transition. For all the administrative staff who worked to remove barriers to services and operations, for our infection control team who continues to provide leadership in improving protocols, for information services staff who enable our communications and instant access to records, and for provider network and agency supervisors whose unquestionable commitment is building workforce resiliency and consumer confidence. On behalf of the agency's management team, please accept our most humble and heartfelt appreciation for all that has been accomplished these last 2 months on behalf of the most vulnerable citizens in Central Michigan. Thank you, thank you, thank you. There are many voices weighing in on how to pull out of this pandemic. And I'm certain we all have something to say about it. I will say this, that as long as the supply chain for personal protective equipment remains competitive, and as long as we continue to experience challenges in obtaining necessary tests, as well as contact tracing in Central Michigan, conversations about reopening or going back to the old normal will be more of an exercise than a reality. We have to have the confidence that we can provide services that will keep people healthy and safe. It's a must. Coronavirus has impacted staff and consumers in all six of our counties during the public health emergency. The increase of COVID-19 incidents is severely straining the direct care workforce across the state, and by now, you are all aware of the governor's declaration of a temporary wage increase. Tanya will provide an update on the latest information this morning, letting you know what you need to do so we can make the May 14 check run. We are closely monitoring the state financial fallout from the economic downturn caused by COVID-19. The forecast for this fiscal year is $1.7 billion less general fund than budgeted to operate this year. University of Michigan has made some projections as well on the overall projected budget of $2.6 billion shortage. That includes school aid fund and other. Some assets to work with. The state has $1.2 billion rainy day fund. There are still unspent monies from the vetoes. And the federal government has relaxed state Medicaid match funds by 6.2% to help offset state costs and drawing down Medicaid dollars. The federal stimulus money is earmarked only for COVID-19 expenditures. But the state will work to apply whatever it can to plug budget holes created by COVID-19. Last fall, you heard of our agency's difficulty receiving anticipated revenue in what turned out, after much investigation, to be errors in the CHAMPS system, errors made by MDHHS, as well as a faulty rate setting by the actuaries. The effect of those problems persisted through April, just last month. And frankly, we are hoping to have our first clean revenue payment in May. Just yesterday, we got a first look at the effect of newly revised actuarial rates, and we will need some time to analyze those numbers while we keep an eye on the legislature for proposed adjustments to this year's budget. The state is also a few weeks away from submitting additional applications for more COVID-19 disaster relief monies from the federal government for behavioral health. Recently, we sent out a advocacy ask to reach out to your congressman to bring additional monies to the behavioral health system. I think it was around $38 billion. And we're still waiting on that. The last November, I talked to you about the public mental health system redesign project. That is now delayed. And it is now defunded. But a supplemental budget was passed by the legislature recently. And the full-time positions that were being asked of by Robert Gordon in the MDHHS budget were struck by the governor for the purpose of beginning to save dollars to address the state budget shortfall. So parallel to that effort and the wonderment as to whether or not the system redesign will rise again. The CARES Act at the federal level offers the potential for an alternative statewide system redesign called CCBHC, or Certified Community Behavioral Health Centers. This provides much more comprehensive services and could draw down even more federal funds. There are some CMHs in the state that are participants in a demonstration of the CCBHC model. I think there's strong indications that Michigan may be selected, but we're going to wait to get a final confirmation before we start delving into the ins and outs of what that might mean for us as a CMH. Currently, there isn't an official confirmation. We are celebrating a total grant award of $400,000 to further enhance the Integrated Health Dashboard Project. We have also joined efforts with the Midland Mental Health Court, established in January, to divert persons from incarceration. So those are a couple of good news points for you. I want to close by reminding you to please send us your feedback and your ideas. Please don't hold back on your feedback thinking we have a full plate already, because we do. But your past contributions have made us strong for today. So don't hesitate to share your thoughts for a stronger tomorrow for everyone. We truly appreciate your partnership as we navigate these uncharted waters. And I just thank you for your time. Any questions on what I said? I know Tanya said we have a packed agenda. Okay. Do you have any questions? You can also put them over on the chat. Tanya?
Thank you, John. Next, we'll move along to the fourth item on the agenda this morning, charting the life course. I have Lisa Martinson and Cindy Seeger, who's going to give you guys a little in-service this morning. And we'll try to make it as effective as we can with technology. This is the first go for us, so be patient, please.
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. Good
morning, Cindy.
Am I all set to share screen?
You are.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. I'm Lisa Martinson. I am a program supervisor in Mecosta County. I saw a lot of providers on the call, and I just want to reiterate what John said. What a fantastic group of providers we have, and you know, I'm proud of all of you. Okay, so charting the life course, I'm gonna try some things here, and this is my first go around with share screen with this big group of folks. But if you can see here, here is our, oh boy.
We can see it, Lisa.
Okay, here is our navigation tools and the kind of what we're gonna go through this morning. Again, I'm Lisa Martinson. Let's start out with charting the life course. What charting the life course is a more of a philosophy. Person-centered planning started, I've been around long enough, I think around 1995. And what that did is helped the mental health system and all of us make sure that we were putting the person at the center of everything we do. So what I like to call charting the life course is self-determination and person-centered planning on steroids. It's really a way to have families and individuals make choices about their life and help us as stakeholders and the community to support them in doing that. So with that said, again, I'm Lisa Martinson. I have worked with people for 20 years. I don't know, maybe 25. I don't know. I'm getting close to something important. But I started out with kids and families. Then I went to an ACT team. Then I came to Hope Network, which was probably my favorite job on the planet. I got to know so many people in the community. And I got to know so much more about individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And it reminded me of a friend I had when I was a kid who lived just down the road. He really was the only kid because I lived on Falmouth Road in McBain, Michigan, which was a two-track at the time. And so I'd walk down to Thad's house, and I didn't know when I was a kid that he had a developmental disability, but he and I we spent a lot of time together growing up, and Thad had a seizure disorder, so he had seizures lots of times when I was with him. And, you know, my whole class, we were a class of 32 at McBain High School, and my whole class really wrapped around Thad, all the administrators, and we really didn't even pay attention to that. And I miss him. I've lost contact with him, but he had such an impact on my life. And at that point, when I went to work at Hope Network, you know, I realized my love for that population. I love all the populations I've worked with. Charting the Life course is not only for providers. The model can be used, the tools can be used for anybody. Actually, I'm using them right now for my 19-year-old transitioning adults. who is in the bedroom and probably going to walk through at some I hope there's not dust on the back of my on my furniture behind me. I have been trying to keep up with all the precautions at home, but I'm not the best duster. And that, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Cindy Seeger. She is my partner.
All right. Thanks, Lisa. I guess that I just for in regards to introduction, I am Cindy Seeger. I work as a currently as the case management supervisor here in Isabella County. Like Lisa, I came up in this field for quite some time. I think I've been probably working in this field for about 25 years also. Much like Lisa's background, a lot of my experience was gained in a vocational rehabilitation facility, which was Mid-Michigan Industries, focusing a lot on people's employment outcomes. I have worked at Community Mental Health for about 8 years as a case manager, a crisis worker, and now a supervisor. That's sort of my work history and where I got to this place. I think part of why I get really excited about charting the life course is probably more to do sort of on a personal note. I have two sons that receive services at Community Mental Health. My youngest son is 22 years old and has a cognitive impairment. He has Down syndrome. And I really feel like charting the life course has been a really good set of tools for us to help kind of figure out the, what's happening in his life and where we're going. Because sometimes we think professionals, we're supposed to know how to do everything, but that's not necessarily the case. I would just say in a nutshell, the thing I love about charting the life course, like person-centered planning, it's about the person. But where person-centered planning focuses a lot on what people's hopes and dreams are, I think charting the life course gets down to the nitty-gritty of what does a good life look like for me and what do I need to get there? And I think it has some really good hands-on tools to do to use to get there.
Okay, am I back?
Yep, you're back.
Thanks, Cindy.
Sure.
Okay, so here we go with the navigation, everybody. Just please bear with me. I'm going to stop sharing this, and then I'm going to go to a different screen.
I said to somebody not too long ago, I thought we lived long enough to not have to learn a whole bunch of new stuff, but clearly that's not the case. We're learning stuff every day.
Almost there. I said to Cindy this morning, boy, my internet is super fast. Now that I need it to be super fast, it's a little bit super slow. Okay, so what you're about to watch is just an introductory video that talks a little bit about charting the life course. It's about 16 minutes, so it's fairly short. I will try to make it big screen and then share it. And then get the... Sorry about that. Okay, here we go.
Hi, Hi, my name is Shelley Reynolds, and I work at the University of Missouri, Kansas City Institute for Human Development. In my role at the Institute, I'm the director of the Individual Advocacy and Family Support Team, where I've worked with families, self-advocates, and professionals for the last 20 years to really identify what their issues are around problem solving and planning and how we can better support them in those roles. What brought me to the...
Sorry, you guys, I'm trying to make the screen... There we go.
The Institute for Human Development, though, was my passion for really helping people have good lives. This came not only from my schooling, but more importantly, because of the fact that I have a brother with a developmental disability who's now in his 30s. Through my day-to-day experience of growing up as a sibling, and also as I got older, serving in the role of really helping to understand, support, navigate them, and work with other people to really help Eric have the life that he wants, really serves as the foundation for much of the work that I do. One of the core principles of the Life Course framework is really how is the work driven by self-advocates and families. What's key to our work is really understanding what it is that they need in their lives so we can figure out the practices and policies to best support that. Everything that you will see today is driven by those voices and those needs. So now I'm going to provide an overview of the Life Course framework that we use to really guide our thinking and how we develop the tools that we use. At the core of this framework is the belief that all people have the right to live, love, work, and play, and pursue their dreams as all others in their community. What's really important about this belief is that there was a time where people with developmental disabilities didn't have access to these rights. So this framework really highlights the fact that everyone has this same right as a citizen in the United States. The other importance of that core belief is the concept of all. And I want to kind of take you to really understanding what we mean when we start talking about all. When we first set out to develop this framework, we wanted to really recognize that when we're talking about people specifically with developmental disabilities, we aren't just talking about those that receive services, but rather all people, the 4.7 million people that are estimated to have a developmental disability in the United States. As we developed the framework, though, we realized this framework was something that was much more universal that could use for all people. It could be used for family members, it could be used for grandparents, it could be used by siblings, for lots of different reasons, not only for the reason of helping people with developmental disabilities. So I'd like to set the stage so that you understand why we needed to come up with this framework. If you look at the circles on the left and just think about your own life, you're an individual person. You have family, you have friends, you exist in the community. And if you start thinking about those with developmental disabilities and how they've received supports over the years, you start realizing that you have the person, you have services wrapped around them, sometimes special education, sometimes adult services, then you have the family, and then you have the community. And as we got focused more and more on those services, what we soon realized was that it was the person being cut off from their family and friends, which was exactly what we did not intend to do with our support system. So this framework really recognizes that and really attempts to figure out a way that how can we support people within the context of their family, their friends, and their community. So if you look at the circles on the right-hand side, you'll see the image there that we're trying to achieve. We want to help people be where they are with the families and friends around them and the community they live in, but figure out a way to integrate services and supports so they can have the good life that they're desiring. One of the reasons that we believe that integrated services and supports are so important are that there are many things that are changing. There's pressures coming from lots of different ways. We have self-advocates and families really, really demanding that their rights are recognized as citizens in this country. We also have the response of federal policy changing, where we're developing a federal infrastructure that really supports those rights to live in the community, have employment, have friends, and be a part of the society. But there's also other realities. We know that there's not enough money in the world for every person with a developmental disability to have all of the services that they desire. So we need to think differently. We need to figure out a way to develop an infrastructure so that everyone can have a good life, but utilizing lots of types of supports. What we also know is there's a lot of changing demographics. We know that baby boomers are getting older. They are going to require supports and services, and they're going to have a demand for them differently as well. We also know that the pool of people providing these supports is getting smaller and smaller, which is really causing us to have a crisis in terms of the day-to-day supports and how they're provided to people. All of these things combined together really cause us to need to think differently about how services and supports are offered in our country. So we keep talking about this phrase, integrated services and supports, but what does that really mean? Well, we utilize the STAR, or if you can think about it, the 5 points of a STAR, to really think about how we can have the good life that we want. If you think about it, the first part of the STAR is really thinking about what personal strengths and assets are you bringing to the table? What skills and ability, what interests do you have? What resources do you have? But we also need to really be paying attention to how are we using technology? Many of you use technology for day-to-day things. How are we using technology to get through the day? Or even maybe to provide some form of long-term supports? How are we using technology for adaptive equipment to help us do the day-to-day activities? We also know there's people in our lives. We call that relationship-based supports. Who's available? Who's a part of your life? Who really helps you get by day-to-day? We also know the community. We have community-based supports. These are places that anybody goes to. You can use the bus, you can go to the YMCA, you can go to your faith-based organization, you can go to the movie theater. All of those types of places really create to the supports to having a good life. But what we most commonly think about when we're thinking about people with developmental disabilities is the last one, and that's the former eligibility-based service system. We often go straight there before we start thinking about the other types of supports. And if you go back to our statistics of really thinking about people with developmental disabilities, we know only 1 in 4 people may have access to long-term services. So that requires us to think very, very differently. So if only 1 in 4 are going to access that, we still have other people that we have to strategize with to really think about how to create a good life. The other thing that's really important to think about is where people live. You know, if I go out and I talk to people out on the street and I start saying, well, where do people with developmental disabilities live? Oftentimes a citizen would say to me, I don't know, a group home, or doesn't the government take care of them? But the reality is that over 89% of people with developmental disabilities live at home with their families, live in their own home, are somehow connected to their families. Most people with developmental disabilities don't move out into some form of eligibility-based living. As our field continues to evolve and really focus on providing person-centered supports, we really need to think about what that means. Providing person-centered supports doesn't mean ignoring the family or ignoring what we would call the context of that family. If you think about your own life, your family's had a big impact on you. Whether you talk to your family currently or not, your hobbies, your likes, your dislikes, your history, the people you know, all really comes from your family and how you grew up. But you also think about it, your expectations, your aspirations are impacted by your family. Your family also brings to it a certain sense of culture, a certain sense of membership, a certain sense of like where and how you see the world. So to truly provide person-centered supports, whether you're doing that in long-term services, whether you're doing that in the educational settings with IEPs or individualized education plans, we really need to be thinking about the person in the context of their family. When we're thinking about family, for some people, that actually might mean the members of the family. Who's actually at the table helping provide day-to-day supports, helping to think through those day-to-day supports, or really, who's there just to love and care for a person? When we think about the family, what we're trying to understand is sort of the reciprocal roles they have to each other. Family members love and care about each other. They know their history. They have a long-term commitment to them, as well as providing that day-to-day support. And if you think about it, as a family member, my mom provided a lot of support to me when I was a baby and as I was growing older. And as I was getting older, we sort of reciprocated, or we did it for each other. Sometimes I emotionally supported her. Sometimes she financially supported me. And so that's what we mean by reciprocal role. And even if you look into aging, you know, oftentimes family members are providing supports to their moms and dads and their grandparents. So this reciprocal role of being in each other's lives is so very, very important. So at the core of our framework is really understanding not only the person's desires, but how that really fits into both the family member's desires and that whole family unit and what that really looks like. So now that we know who we're talking about, we're not only talking about the person, maybe with a disability, but also the family members. We really need to understand what are the three things that they need. And we talk about these in terms of buckets. We know that people need information. They need the skills and they need an awareness about what's possible. They need to understand the services and supports and how they can help people get to their desired outcome. But we also know that people need peer support. They need to be connected to one another. They need that emotional support to really get out of bed each day. So sometimes that might mean having someone to call on the phone. Sometimes that might mean a support group. Sometimes that might mean going to a place that totally included you and made you feel a part of their community. We have to really pay attention to that second bucket of support. What our field typically thinks about when they're thinking about supporting the person or their family, though, is the third bucket. And that third bucket is goods and services. The goods and services are the day-to-day things you need to get by. So it could be financial support. It could be the day-to-day caregiving or the support needs that you might have. It might be the accommodations. It could even be support for the caregiver to have health and wellness to ensure that they can take care of themselves so they can take care of their family. So when we're thinking about our key principles, these three support buckets are something that we believe all people need. So many of the things that I've already talked to you about are probably things that maybe you knew about or you have access to. But one of the new things that the Life Course Framework brings to the conversation is really talking about this concept called the trajectory. And the reason we think it's so important is that a lot of times in the disability field, we start thinking about services not proactively, but rather they're very crisis-driven. They're when something's wrong or something needs to change, and then we start looking for services and supports. What the trajectory is really designed to do is to really help us start thinking proactively. How can we help people start thinking about where they're at right now, but also where do they want to go in the future? What is their vision? What is it that they're seeking that they need right now that's going to help them achieve what's ahead of them as they get older? But what we also know is this concept of really helping people be able to articulate what don't they want. So if you start thinking about it, many people know what they don't want. Maybe they're a little unclear of what they do want, but they can definitely tell you what it is that they don't want. I ask that question to parents all the time, and they say things like, I don't want my child to be lonely. I don't want them to be abused. I don't want them to be harmed. I don't want them to be dependent on people. We know by thinking about what they don't want and thinking about their trajectory, we can begin problem solving and developing the supports that are important to them. Now, when we start thinking about the trajectory, the other thing that we really want to start highlighting is this concept of thinking about life experiences. We have a tendency to really only want to think about services and supports and what's available, as opposed to really thinking about it, what are the life experiences that are going to get me to where I want to go in life? So let's look at an example. Let's think about employment. You know, having an internship or going to college or maybe use Invoke Rehab are all really, really important steps to getting a job or leading to a career. But we also need to be thinking about what happens when you're younger, having chores, setting expectations, learning about money, learning about social skills. Those are all really, really important life experiences that are also going to benefit and lead to you getting a job. Without those life experiences, the formal service systems by themselves cannot create the outcomes that we desire. The other key principle of the Life Course Framework is really thinking across life domains. The developmental disability field historically has only focused on health and safety. And although those are important domains, what we want to do with this framework is to really broaden people's understanding about what's important to the good life. And what we know is that you have to be thinking about, what do I do during the day? How is my health and wellness? Where do I live? How do I stay safe? How do I have friends? And how am I involved socially? So what we've done here is we've really created icons and domains so that we can really hone in on those specific areas, but also talk about how they're all interconnected to one another. So now I'm going to briefly summarize everything we've talked about today. First, we think about the person. We think about their personal strengths and their assets, their resources, their skills, their interests. But we also need to think about that person and how they relate to their family. And thinking about the context of the family's desires, the individual members' desires. So then when we think about the next ring, what we do here is think about the quality of life of both the person and every member of that family. Thinking about each one of their life domains separately, but also integrated. So when we start thinking about all of the individual family members and what they need, we really start thinking about that in terms of the three buckets. What are their informational needs? What's the sort of skill and awareness and understanding that they need? What are their peer support needs, the emotional needs, the connection needs that they have? Do they need to be connected with other family members, with other self-advocates, or maybe siblings connected to other siblings? But we also can't forget about the third bucket, the goods and service buckets. What are the day-to-day supports that they need? What are the financial supports that they might need? What are the caregiving supports that might be there? So we need to be thinking about that ring of supports. But we need to do all of this through the lens of what we call our integrated service and support star. Are we thinking about their personal assets? Are we thinking about the relationships, the technology that they can use to problem solve or plan with? Are we thinking about the places that they go that anybody can access in the community, as well as more formal eligibility-based supports that are available? So what I just provided for you was just a basic overview of the key principles of the Charting the Life Course framework. I hope that provides you a good understanding of how to get started as you're working on your journey towards having a good life. Do know there are lots of other tools and resources that can help you both dig deeper into the principles to guide your thinking, but also some very practical tools that you can use for problem solving. Check out our website at lifecoursetools.com to get this information.
Okay, let's see here. So we're gonna exit that. And then Cindy and I are, is there any questions about the video? Any comments?
I would only like to add that I think that the video does a really good job giving an overview of Charting the Life Course, and we'll go into a little bit more depth of some of those areas. But the really cool part about Charting the Life Course is on their website, there's access to all of this information. It's really easily designed to be visually pleasing, but also user friendly. So that's really cool. And I just kind of wanted to preface some of our conversation by saying, you know, at Community Mental Health, the reason Charting the Life Course is really important is that we're really trying to work on that in the person-centered planning process, and that pre-planning part of the person-centered planning process where we're trying to get at what people's hopes and dreams are and what they want in their lives. We feel like Charting the Life Course is a really good way to frame some of those conversations. And so you may have already had some experience with some caseholders using these tools or have talked about it a little bit. What we're hoping to do over the course of the next year or so is to really bring Charting the Life Course more into action across domains in our community.
Right, thank you, Cindy. Okay, so we're going to do the screen share again, and really it's just going to be about kind of demonstrating the navigation. That agenda that we started out with this morning that had all the links on it will be sent to all of you with the minutes, and so that will just give you the links. But really, I'm going to just show you how simple it is to get there and kind of how simple it is to navigate, and then we'll go through some of these tools. So share screen. Okay, so hopefully I can make it look simple. So that's just a Google toolbar, Charting the Life Course. I've been there 10,000 times, so can everybody see me going from page to page? Okay. Okay, so this is the main the main website for Charting the Life Course, and all the tools and things are across the top here. That video we just watched, if you see, it's right there under videos. And then there's some other really cool videos, yay employment. So there's some tools related to employment and things like that. But over here is kind of the beginning, the life course principles, which she talked about in the video. Whoops. I apologize. My cursor gets a little sensitive. So this is where she talked about 100, you know, the 4.7 million people with developmental disabilities, and only one or four of those are receiving services and supports. And then the life cycle, you know, the early childhood, the school age, the, let's see, it's a test in my knowledge of this, the transition life cycle, then the adult life cycle, and then the aging life cycle. And so those are all separated here. If you see along here by their colors and by what area and time frame of the person's life you're planning for. So that's what all these colors mean. I'm advocating right now, John and Tanya, for a color printer. But I think we have one. okay. And then this is the, obviously, the integrated supports over here. Sorry, my picture is kind of interrupting it. But integrated supports the areas of life around here in this circle. And again, it gives really good description down here of what each of those things are. If I go down, it talks about the life domains, the three buckets, the integrated supports, and then policy. And some states are using charting the life course, which I found fascinating. You know, where we're at in Michigan compared to some other states and using these tools. And many, I did hear of one state who's using it for implementation of home and community-based services. So I thought that was really cool. Okay, next up is forming a vision, Cindy, and let me see if I can get us there. Let me just look at the link real quick. Okay.
There we go. Whoops, I was muted. I'm sure lots of people would hope that I would stay muted, but that's okay. So I'll get started on just talking about, so the tool that we're going to talk about next is developing the vision. I really like this tool because I think it helps break down those domains that Lisa was talking about into categories with some specific questions that can help people in formulating, you know, what does a good life look like for me? I make this joke all the time about, you know, with persons that are planning, you know, what are my hopes and dreams? You know, if you talk to Logan, you know, his hope would be that he moved to California, and his dream would be that the movie star he loves would get a divorce and marry Logan. So, you know, people have hopes and dreams, but then they also have things that could also be put together to make a good life. Maybe we don't recognize all of our hopes and dreams. So in the tool for developing a vision, there's two separate tools. There's one for the family and one for the individual. It goes through those life domains and just asks specific questions. For instance, in daily employment, you know, what do I think my family member is going to be doing for employment, you know, as they get older? Where do I think they're going to live? With whom do I think they're going to live? What's interesting is to do this with the family and the individual separate to see if their visions are similar or not. Sometimes they're very similar and sometimes they're not. But it's a good place to have a conversation about, you know, what is it that I think a good life will look like in all of these different areas. The other thing I like about this tool, the way that it's broken up, is because it does it by domain, it helps me to think about all the different areas of Logan's life or whoever's life it is that I'm working with, instead of just focusing on one or two. Sometimes it's really difficult. You know, I love employment too. Yay, Lisa. But one of the things that I've struggled with over the years is that, you know, Logan and employment maybe looks a little bit different. You know, if Logan works 10 hours a week competitively, we'll be very happy. However, that leaves a lot of hours in his life that need to be filled up with other things. And so sometimes in school and even in some of our services that we provide, we're so focused on employment that we forget about some of those other areas of his life. So I really like this tool because it helps us to think about healthy living, safety and security. You know, one of the things that as a family member that's super concerning for us is, you know, not just Logan being happy, but having him be safe and secure. And what does that look like? And it changes as he gets older. So I really like this tool. Again, under, you know, with Charting the Life course, this tool is very visually pleasing and it's very easy to use. These are not tools that take a lot of education and learning about. You know, you can pull up these tools and start learning and having conversation right away.
Thank you, Cindy.
Sure.
Okay, back to the main webpage and the next, Exploring the Good Life. Let me just see if I know what I'm talking about here, which is not normal. I normally don't.
This one, I think Lisa's on the bottom left-hand side.
On this page?
Yep, I think so. Maybe not.
Was it on the person-centered planning link?
Potentially.
Oh, you know, I think that is that the the principles.
So exploring the life possibilities was the form that talks about the different life domains. What I liked about exploring the life possibilities was it talked about, like, so in the visions, it says, where do I envision my person being? Like, where are they going to live? This tool, exploring life possibilities, talks about community living and what it might look like. So it gives a lots of different ways in which people do live in the community, whether it's in a semi-independent living, living in an adult foster care home, living in their own apartment. It kind of gives you some ideas and thoughts about what those things might look like. And then it kind of was interesting because on the bottom it talks about like the traditional things. Like when we talk about employment with a person with a developmental disability, traditionally we might think about things like the like a workshop or a vocational setting or a day program. Those are old terms, I realize that. But part of some of the things we might think about, and I know we're working on this with our vocational providers, are what does competitive employment look like? What does a micro enterprise look like? You know, what are some of the opportunities that might be available? You know, when you have a person, when you have a family member that's a person with a disability, you may or may not have ever been exposed to a person with a disability your entire life. So this may be your first opportunity to experience what it's like to have a disability. And so you may not even know what opportunities are out there for the person. So I loved this Exploring Life Possibilities tool because it gave some ideas in each of the life domains.
I think we were talking about this one, Cindy, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Where you put the vision for what you want and, you know, talk about the things that you don't want and all of that.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, for the trajectory.
And that's where you're starting to talk about your trajectory and think about it in terms of, you know, putting it on a trajectory for, you know, the things alongside here of what you do or do not want.
Yeah.
So, okay. Okay, so next up is the Star Map, Cindy, and I'm not just going to go to that blank one that I have the link for on the agenda. I'm going to go to this one because this one really gives whoever's using the tool the ability to think about the questions that they need to ask. Darn it. I got a cursor that doesn't, not real cooperative. Oh, just for fun, Cindy, I'm going to make you use the employment one. But there's one for respite. There's one for community living.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the one for employment.
Do you want to go through that one, Lisa?
Sure, absolutely. So what this is that star. So if you see the star in the middle of the page, obviously you start out with a person with a blank star and with the headers in each area. And so their personal strengths. Do they have chores and responsibilities at home? If they do, what are those? Do they use an alarm to wake up and get ready for school or work on their own? Do you have to set that for them? Can they set that themselves? all of these are going to be great goals and interventions in our plan, and it is going to feed in nicely to helping providers and staff working with individuals to know exactly what they're working on a very micro level, and individualized, I guess, is a better word. So do they know how to access transportation? What portion of that are we helping with, or do we need to help with that? Do they already know how to do that? Do they know how to use a debit card? Are they able to communicate their needs? So all great questions, and those are in every area here. We do a pretty good job of identifying people's strengths. Sometimes what we haven't done, and I, through this whole COVID-19 thing, we've been really getting better at as providers. I know we've had a lot of you helping us set up. Actually, we haven't had you do it. You've done it on your own, which some of the things you guys are doing are fantastic. We have consumers visiting with family on Zoom. They're using things. I learned about two things yesterday from a provider who told me about, I don't know, Google Duo and Messenger phone calls. And wow, those are all great things that as soon as we get the star map out for those people, we're putting that on there. but this is traditionally an area of technology that we don't do a great job assessing for people, and especially in today's world. Do they know how to do online classes if they want to? Do they know how to download an app? Do they need vehicle modifications? Do they know how to use a calendar? So all of those things. And then over here in relationships as well, you know, sometimes when I think about a person, I hear about Brother John all the time, but I've never really talked to the person about Brother John and what John does for him and, you know, those things. So this really gets down to the level of detail of, you know, where am I at in relationships and what relationships do I still need to build? Sometimes they divide these support stars, each area, into two areas. And one is, where am I at now? And then the other side is kind of where do I want to go? So that's the star map. I don't want to take too much more time, but this is really kind of the meat and potatoes of where you get to asking the right questions, I guess, and exploring the right individualized, instead of going through, you know, our 30-page assessment that is for every population, or, you know, it really kind of individualizes that individual. So, and again, not hard to use. These are all available for free on the website. So there's that form. The next one is the trajectory. Cindy, you want to take over from here? Let me.
I will. I know that Tanya's talking about, we got to kind of hurry up. So obviously you can tell we're pretty excited about all of this. Just in quick, the last page just talks about the trajectory. The biggest thing I would talk about this is that, again, this is about helping people figure out what the good life looks like, and then what are the things that they need, the trajectory, about the supports and services they need to get to that good life. Those supports and services may or may not be paid staff. That is part of it, paid services, but it's also all the other things that go into a person's life in order for them to reach that goal of having the life that they need. Again, I would just wind up by saying, you know, these tools are available online. I would encourage people to explore them, especially if you're having these kind of conversations with families and persons served. It doesn't matter whether they have a developmental disability or any other kind of life trajectory or where they're trying to go. So encourage you to use them. And just an FYI, you're going to be hearing and seeing a lot more of this from the folks from Trinity Mental Health.
Thank you. Thank you, Tanya. Thank you, Cindy, for all the help.
Thanks, Lisa. Good job on the technology.
Well, we didn't get to every form that we had on the list, but everybody's going to get the agenda or the navigational tools in their minutes. And obviously, just check out Google Charting the Course. Check out the website. Over here under training videos, there's stuff for you. There's stuff for your staff. There's stuff, you know, or you can wait, you know, it's fun to check out right now, but we should be having much more, like Cindy said, coming in the next year.
Thanks, ladies. That was very informative. Moving us along, we have trauma-informed care presentation. I have, is Kat with us this morning? Seen.
I am here.
Okay, Kat and Angie Thomas.
All right, I'm going to bring up a PowerPoint. Uh-oh. I'm going to try to share my screen.
Oops.
Thank you, everybody, for your patience. We're all having so much fun. Okay, this is not going the way I want it to. This happened yesterday. Can you guys see it?
Yes.
All right. Now I got it. Woohoo! All right. Ta-da! I'm going to have Angie begin with the introductions.
Hi, everyone. I'm Angie Thomas. I work in our McCust County office. It's so good to be welcomed back to the provider meeting. I haven't been to one in 8 years or so, as I shifted roles about 8 years ago. So I'm very excited to be back. And our topic today was trauma-informed care and the culture of gentleness. And Catherine and I developed this in a short period of time, so I hope that it is what you guys need, because we weren't 100% sure. But it's really how we can support the staff who are supporting the residents through this very difficult and uncharted times. And I know we're all have heard all these words, unprecedented, uncharted, you know, whatever other words have come from it. And as the people support have gone through many mixed emotions and challenging behaviors during this time, as have staff that I support as well. And it was very, this pretty much summed it a couple of weeks ago. One of the therapists that I support said, "This is the first time in my career that I'm experiencing trauma at the same time as the people I work with." And isn't that true? That at least in, you know, I've been around since 1986, so there has been periods in the world where there have been traumatic times, but this has really touched the heart of many of us. And we are all experiencing the social distancing and being away from our families and the survival mode that happened right away, having to make extreme changes to our lifestyle. And how do we support ourselves? How do we support the people we're supporting? And then as providers, we also need to support the staff, which, by the way, fantastic job. I love hearing everything that people have been doing and how the creative ideas that have been going on. And so Catherine is going to take over from here. And if there's any questions, we will get to those at the end. Go ahead, Kat.
All right. So obviously we're all inundated and immersed in the topic of COVID-19, whether we want to be or not. Pretty much you turn on your TV, it's on the commercials, news, talk shows. If you see some of the YouTubes coming out, which are quite funny and entertaining. Also, we have our conversations, texts, emails at work with our friends and family. Social media, that brings on a whole new challenge because a lot of people have very strong opinions about COVID-19 and what's occurring right now. So it's stirring up lots of feelings for people, some anger. Also, in our news, every day we're getting updates on new cases and deaths in Michigan. And also we get information across the country and in other countries as well. The one plus is at least we've added on recoveries, so it gives a little bit of hope. It's not just all about who has the diagnosis and who's dying, but it's hard to escape. So the outbreak of COVID-19, as we know, has been very stressful on all of us. There's a lot of fear and anxiety, and we know that people just will respond differently to these kinds of stressful situations. It really depends on our backgrounds, our life experiences. We've talked before about ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences. So these are some things to be aware of. Especially because many of the individuals, the residents in your homes, have these backgrounds. They've had traumatic experiences. Those include abuse, neglect, family violence, or even school or community violence, loss or separation of parents during childhood. If they've had a life-threatening illness or accident, if they've been in extreme poverty, these are not all of them, but some significant ones to take into account. Also, resiliency factors, that determines how we will respond to times that we're dealing with like now. The number one resilient factor is having a sensitive, nurturing, responsive adult in your life during your childhood, support from family, friends, people at school and in the community. Also, having a sense of safety, know that you're going to be protected. And of course, right now, many of us are challenged with that because it doesn't feel safe. If you have increased self-esteem, spiritual and cultural beliefs, if you have a sense of meaning or purpose in your life, that is a resilient factor. If you have a talent or skill, so during your childhood, if you excelled at school or in a sport, and the bottom line, it's coping skills. Like we all know people that are negative Nellies and then positive Patties. A lot of times that will determine how we deal with our current circumstances. So we also know that certain people react more strongly to stress of a crisis. And this comes from the CDC. They're saying the older people and people with chronic diseases who are at higher risk for COVID-19, children and teens, people who are helping with response to COVID-19, like doctors and other healthcare providers or first responders. And this includes all of us as well, you know, all of you providers and your staff, as well as the residents. And people who have mental health conditions, including problem with substance abuse. So we know that stress during an infectious disease outbreak can include fear and worry, not just about our own health, but the health of people that we love, the health of people that we're caring for. Changes in sleep or eating patterns. This is really important to pay attention to if people are struggling with sleep, eating a lot or not eating. These are signs that they may be having struggles dealing with the stress. If they have worsening or chronic health problems, difficulty sleeping or concentrating, or if there's increased use of alcohol, tobacco, or other drugs. Again, all of these resources can be found on CDC. I just took out ones that were really pertinent to us. And the ways to manage and reduce stress and anxiety, share the facts about COVID-19 and understand the actual risk to this yourself and the people you care for. We've seen lots of information come out that isn't always accurate, especially if we're getting our information solely off of social media. So we really need to be careful. In fact, when I share stuff with my staff, if I don't know if it to be a fact, I let them know that. And I'll look into it and try to verify. Participate in activities that bring joy. That can be anything. I know that for a lot of our staff, they're taking on different hobbies than they have before, like gardening is an example of that. Talk to people you trust about your feelings. That can be anybody, whether it be a family member, friend, coworker. Connecting with others. I think there are some people that are going to be more isolative during this time period, but it's really important to keep trying to reach out, even though it's harder when we can't, you know, approach someone and give them a hug or even have a close face-to-face conversation. Take breaks from watching, reading, and listening to news stories. I think this has been huge. There are some people that are really struggling with turning off, and it's important to do that and get some balance in our lives. Take care of your body and your mental health. Eat healthy, well-balanced meals, regular exercise, plenty of sleep, and avoid alcohol and drugs if they're being used to self-medicate.
So how can we, as providers, help our staff who therefore support our residents? And going back to the culture of gentleness, and I just want to shout out to Lisa and Cindy for their great presentation on charting the life course, because that is an awesome philosophy that I think we could use in so many places other than like schools and with our children with SED who are transitioning into adulthood too. But it also goes so very well with the culture of gentleness as well. And so really going back and remembering the central purpose of the culture of gentleness, which is really our presence in the lives of others, which is to nurture, teach, and sustain that experience that we are talking about in the life course too, the sense of connectedness, companionship, and community. And I understand there's really challenging times right now to help support staff with this and our residents, because we aren't allowed to connect with them like using some of our tools, some of our hands, some of our body presence, because we're not there. So we really have to rely on other tools like our eyes and our words and be very mindful of how we communicate with people. So remembering and going back to the central purpose of the culture of gentleness. And Kat, you want to go to the next slide, please? So what are some things we can do as supervisors and leaders? So one of the things that we can do is check in with our teams on a regular basis. You know, and I'm sure you're all doing this, calling them, texting them, having increased staff meetings. I'm having weekly meetings with my staff, and I think that they enjoy it so much, just ask them, no. But really touching base with them, how you doing, asking about how they are doing, asking about how their families are doing. Because remember, going back to that quote, the people that we are supporting, our staff and ourselves, are experiencing the same trauma as the people that we support. So really having to have that sense of companionship and connectedness. Allowing a person and letting them know that you're a safe person to talk to, that you respect and value the work that they're doing, and giving them time to share their fears and anxieties, whether it's their own fears and anxieties or fear and anxieties about the people they're supporting, fears and anxieties about their jobs, just giving them a safe place to be able to share that. And encouraged to touch base every shift. You know, I don't know if you have like even a 10 minute shift report, and just like, hey, how are people doing? And reminding people, using those six elements of the culture of gentleness, you know, setting up an environment of safety, an environment where people are feeling valued and respected, and remembering, especially during this time, to give the staff and the people we support increase positive interactions. And sometimes we have to lower our demands, and lowering our demands could mean that if the dishes are supposed to be done at 7 p.m., but there's a couple of residents having a really hard time, then we scrap the dishes right now and we focus on what we can do for them. And it's really important during this time of people not able to go to work, not able to do some of the activities that they were normally able to do, to really plan and have structure, and then prepping for those transition times. And I know a lot of you do such a great job with that, with the vision boards and people having their own personal calendars and really looking at what can we fill our time with, because people aren't able to go to work right now or do some of their other activities. And some other things, we want to continue to support the direct support professionals and residents. We just talked about that, having a structure. We really want to look at the gifts that our team brings to us. What do our direct support staff, what do our home managers, what are the gifts that they have? What are the gifts that our residents bring to those? And really highlighting those right now and keeping everyone, like Catherine had said earlier, keeping everyone involved and updated on plans and what's happening, to be as educated as possible. Remembering to practice active listening, ask those questions, and then as you guys are all doing, it sounds like really challenging the support staff to think about ways to keep people safe, connected while they're providing the care. And some other cool things that we can do is give that special recognition to the leadership for their creativity, their generosity, their love and their support, and their ongoing willingness is the only word I can think of, but that's probably not the right word, of providing that companionship, that community and connectedness. Because especially right now when our folks aren't able to get out as much as they have, a lot of the times it's the staff that are providing this companionship and community and connectedness. And think of ways that we learn through social distancing that highlight the importance of COVID illness. And I, you know, as I was talking to Lisa earlier last week, some of the things that I hear are going on, people are being very creative, doing really cool things with painting, puzzles, and I know you guys, movie night, game nights, gardening, getting Zoom, Google, Duo with families. I mean, there is a lot of cool stuff going on out there, and I really applaud everything that people have been doing and just continue it. And Kat is going to highlight some of the resources.
Yeah, so we just thought we'd have a couple pages of concise resources for all of you to share with DSPs and residents. So there's a warm line that we've listed here, and it's actually manned by certified peer support specialists. There's a disaster distress helpline that provides immediate confidential crisis counseling 24/7, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Brand new is the Crisis Mental Health Support, which is a way to text to get counseling via text. So that just came out by MDHS yesterday. And then, of course, we want you to remember us, because all of our staff are for you and for the residents. Here's some additional resources. I've shared a lot of this with people in the community as well as staff. Headspace is currently offering free meditation, sleep, movement, exercises. Also has some information there for youth. House Party, I've really enjoyed this one because for myself, I have friends and family that have different devices, different phones. And what we found, I have an iPhone, couldn't do FaceTime, but with House Party, we could actually use it as a platform to socialize with multiple people. So you could have a coffee hour if you want, just chat, or it also has games such as trivia and quick draw, and you can play with people from other states or people even in the same house if you so choose. Other resources are Breathe to Relax. Again, it's a way to help reduce stress, deep breathing. There's a virtual hope box, mood tracker, provider resilience. I've gone into all of these, Life Armor. All of them are free. You can download them to your phone. Also available on Google. Provider resilience actually gives you kind of a stress tracker. So daily you can see how you're doing and managing your stress. And Headspace, I did want to share too that there are free workouts being offered by a variety of personal trainers. So if people are staying in, there's an option that's available. I know that Planet Fitness is doing it for free so that you don't have to have a membership. You're able to participate in doing workouts. And across the state, there are other places that are doing that as well. And Headspace also has in-home workouts that guide people through mindfulness exercises, so helping us to be in the moment, not focus so much on what's going to happen in the future. And we also wanted to provide an opportunity for all of you to take a minute or two just to share some creative ways you are supporting DSPs and residents. So has anyone done something within their homes that they would like to share? Because we believe that this may spark something that another provider could do in their homes. I've been stealing lots of ideas from people to do with my staff. And so I want to give that opportunity to all of you.
Be sure to unmute if you want to give some ideas.
Are there any questions?
Yes, you can also chat ideas.
Right.
I'll start. So I had a meeting with a provider yesterday and talked to some of the case managers that their homes are doing. One of the homes has a outdoor game area set up, so you can go out there and play like ring toss, and you can sit at the picnic table, and you can play yard games with your roommates or with the people that are supporting you. So I thought that was cool, a way to get outside and get fresh air. Maybe not this week when it's going to be 40 or 50, but on those nice days that we've had. And then also that home was the one that shared that they were using the Google Duo and the Messenger to interact with families, and they're planning a big Mother's Day celebration and trying to figure out how to do that with technology.
So, yeah, Lisa, thank you for that. I did see that a person asked a question, and I guess I don't know the answer to that, so I don't know if Chris or Jane are still on.
Tanya, can you read the question?
I can, yes. It is. Is there a concern with rights of consumers using House Party? And I think I would have to, you know, obviously let Jane or Chris answer that.
Are they still on?
I think so. We can definitely note that question. Oh, Jane says, I'll do some checking and get back to you. So we'll put the answer in the minutes.
Great. This is Chris. I'm sorry, okay. I can't see myself. I don't know if you can see me.
Oh, we can now. Yep.
I would say I've used House Party with my kids as well, and I can't think of anything that would inherently identify someone as a recipient of mental health services. So that would be one thing, and Jane and I will talk further, but my preliminary answer would be, if it's just Tanya playing House Party with Chris and Jane, there's nothing confidentiality violating about that.
That is a good question, though.
Very good. Thank you.
Is there any other ideas or questions?
Well, again, thank you for inviting us, and I look forward to coming again sometime in the future, maybe not in 8 years.
Thank you all. Appreciate all that you're doing.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, we have the HCBS update. So I have Sarah and Barb. Barb, Sarah, are you there?
I'm here. Sarah's going to share the screen.
Okay. So. And I'm not sure what they just did, but my Zoom screen is gone. Okay.
Oh, no.
Nope, I think I got it now. Okay, can you see my screen now?
Yep, we got it.
Okay. So we would just like to welcome everybody. Temporarily, HCBS has kind of been put on the back burner for a lot of you. But Barb and I are still working together to bring everyone into compliance and prepare for heightened scrutiny visits. The Mid-State Health Network staff contacts has not changed since last time. We still, in our jurisdiction, are working with Bob Pletcher. So a lot of you will be getting emails from him directly, or also Ronald Meyer has been added to help all Bob, Kara, and Paul. And then at CMH, I will be your main contact for HCBS related items. Where we currently stand with surveys for HSW exit ramp, we have 30 that are approved and finalized, 18 additional corrective action plans that documentation or follow-up visits are going to be needed. For the B3, we have 56 approved and 23 additional documentation or follow-up visits are needed. And if you are a provider that is one of those needing additional documentation or follow-up visits, you have from Bob. I've been copied in on all of the emails. They're awaiting a lot of documentation. So if one of them is you, if you can get back with them as soon as possible, that would be great. For heightened scrutiny, for HSW, we have a total of 52 consumers being serviced by 18 providers, and for B3, we have 16 consumers being provided service by 10 providers. Mission was working to finish up all of the site visits and corrective action plans for exit ramp cases prior to March 13th when the Stay Home, Stay Safe order was implemented. And so in a couple more slides, I'll go into a little bit more detail, but they are working to come up with different ideas for how we can do these finish up site visits. All corrective action plans have to be completed and remediated by August of 2020. And based on a meeting we had last week with Mid-State, they do not expect that to be extended for any reason. Already extended once up to August 2020. So we are going to have to get creative with how we get these site visits and follow-ups done. All on-site visits are currently on hold, and last week during our meeting, they are discussing the possibility of online and video visits to follow up on initial site visits already completed. So what this means is Mid-State was out on your site and had additional follow-up information that had to be done. It might have been locks need to be changed, locks need to be removed. And normally I would be the one coming out to verify those have been done.
In this time where we can't be entering the homes, we're looking at doing the Zoom meeting, some kind of video visit in order to verify that those changes have been made. So once we get a little more information on that from Mid-State, we will share that with those that we have to do those follow-up visits with. The community outings is probably, I'm going to say, 90% of what is holding providers back from being compliant at this time. And as we know, community outings shouldn't be occurring right now with the executive orders restricting them. What Mid-State did tell us is that you can use Zoom or FaceTime or Google or any other platforms to visit and communicate with family and or friends. It was good to hear the last two presenters also talk about that, because Mid-State really is pushing it. I mean, they can talk to their friends via Zoom or FaceTime, and that it may come down to where they include those as not necessarily a community outing, but community integration. They're communicating with people outside of their home. And then we also discussed the opportunity to go back and do a revised outing log. We will not be changing the current outing log, but you can do a revised outing log if the previous ones did not include family outings or declined outings. The family outings was something new just about 6 weeks ago that they came out. Initially, if consumers were leaving the home with family, they were told it did not count as an outing. But upon further research at the Mid-State level, they are now saying that family outings can be included on the outing log. Also, a lot of providers were not keeping track of declined outings. If they were offering outings and people chose not to go, they weren't putting those on the outing log. And so if they have record of that based on progress notes, they can go back and do a revised outing log to make those changes. And for heightened scrutiny, this week we were supposed to start having our site visits. But as we know, that's not going to happen as scheduled. If they could start visits this week, which we know they can't, they're approximately 7 weeks behind. We will be getting, once Michigan State University determines when they will be able to start them, I will be getting a spreadsheet from them of where they plan to go and when. And I will be in contact with providers and case managers, as both need to be present at the site visits. And I will be working to coordinate those for all of the providers on heightened scrutiny. But I went out and checked again today, and we've been sent nothing further other than we're going to wait to hear when they can start those back up and what our new dates will be. I also just completed our 2020 survey validation spreadsheet for Mid-State. This included providers that did not complete the previous surveys, providers that had survey errors, providers that responded indicating independent settings the MDHHS could not validate. So those have all been sent back. So new surveys will be coming out for all of those. And again, we have to remember the surveys are mandatory. If they're not being completed, the provider can be determined to not be HCBS compliant, and at that time we would start the transition process. So with that being said, please, please, please monitor your email, check your spam and junk folders. I know that every email that I'm copied in on from Mid-State, if I don't get a response from the provider, I'm also emailing, I'm reaching out via phone. I've contacted some case managers that are out in the homes or talking to the homes more frequently to get better phone numbers, to get in contact with everybody. So please be monitoring that and follow up when you see those emails. And then Barb is going to talk about the statewide transition plan.
Okay. Michigan has an updated HCBS transition plan, which is available on their website for your review and comment. Comments are due by May 22nd by emailing hcbstransition@michigan.gov. We'll go over the three major changes with this revision. And the first one is that all settings will be validated. This includes those that were determined compliant by the HCBS survey process, and the deadline for that validation is December 1st of 2020. For the settings that were out of compliance, the validation deadline is August 1st, 2020. And for those in heightened scrutiny status, it's September 1st of 2021. The next big change is that the transition process is outlined in the transition plan. And this is for individuals receiving services and settings that are unable to come into compliance. And they have to be notified by September 1st, 2021, if that is the case. Because there's a minimum 6-month transition time to transition to an HCBS compliant setting. The revised plan details the process, including communication from MDHHS to the case manager. And the third major change includes ongoing reassessment and monitoring to ensure ongoing HCBS compliance. The process includes surveys for both providers and participants, and provider surveys are mandatory. Validation of the survey results will occur and may include a site visit. And also, this will involve corrective action plans, heightened scrutiny process, as we've been going through currently. Reviews are required to make sure that all providers are HCBS compliant. And we have our resources posted on our website, and you can also get to them through the cmhcm.org website. The link has moved, though. It's now under the providers, and it's the very bottom link, HCBS resources. And it will take you to the MDHHS website, which includes this revised transition plan for your review and comment. Okay, next slide. There's also a link to DDI's website that includes resources as well.
Anybody have any questions for Barbara? And on the last page of the slide, I do have my email address. So if anybody has any questions, concerns, or as you're working through corrective action plans or site visits, feel free to contact me with any questions that you do have.
All right, thank you, ladies. Getting back to the agenda, I'm gonna give the mission update at this time. Along the lines of the mission update, before I get into the true mission updates, I wanna go over some changes. As you know, Governor Whitmer has given the directive for the $2 an hour for direct care workers, and that information came out slightly after CMH with mission guidance to give the increase as well. And since the governor has made that announcement, there's been some changes in the dates of that pass-through. So some clarification on the recent amendment that was received for the service codes of CLS, which is H0043, H2015, H2016, personal care, which is T1020, respite is T1005, and S5151, as well as additional codes that were not included in the First Amendment of skill building H2014 and crisis residential H0018. So effective April 1st through June 30th, those codes will be increased by $2 an hour, which is a direct pass-through to the direct care worker, and the admin rate, which was originally in the First Amendment set at 15%, will be changed to 12% or 24 cents. Bless you. Sarah, there we go. Gotcha. So claims paid will be reconsidered, and providers will need to rebill once the new rates are set up in the system. Claims submitted but not paid will be returned after this morning's meeting so they can be updated with the correct rates. The billing system, as many of you already know, has been shut down at this time to allow for the provider network team to make the changes in the system with the new rates. We intend to have those changes made by the end of this week, if not sooner. There also may be additional codes that could be added as we get further direction. And our hope is that we would update those as of early next week. This is all fresh information, so bear with us as we make the changes that we need to be in compliance with both the original direction that we had in the governor's new direction that we have. This rate increases will be effective back retro to April 1st and continue until June 30th. At this time. It may, however, be lengthened as we get further guidance from the state. The other mission update that I have is that the Provider Network Committee at Mid-State Health Network has been working on the regional contracts for FY21 for inpatient, for autism, and for physical intermediaries. Those have been sent to those provider types for comment and suggestive edits, and those are due back. They were due back already, so if you have any further edits that you want to that standard contract, please get them to me. The last update that I have from mission standpoint is that the code H0043, which is the per diem code for community living supports, is being phased out. And that code will be transitioned at the PCP time or sooner if there's an addendum needed to H2015, which is the old CLS 15-minute code. So you'll be seeing those transitions happening over the course of the next several months as we phase people back out of H0043 into H2015. Does anybody have any questions in regards to the amendment change into the new directive from the state? We will be working, like I said, the provider network team will be working today as soon as we get done with this meeting to get the rates fixed in the system to allow for billing.
Tanya?
Mm-hmm.
This is Leanne. I just want to say real quickly, so as long as claims are, or the batches that get returned to you today are corrected and resubmitted by noon on Wednesday, May 13th, you will be paid May 14th. And just to give you additional time to bill and possibly rebill, Peg and Carrie are also going to complete a check run the following week. So in claims submitted after May 13th at noon, but by noon on May 20th, will be paid on Thursday, May 21st. And then we're still going to have a check run the last week of May as well. So claims submitted by noon on May 27th will be paid on May 28th. So we're going to throw in an extra check run that will help give providers a little more time to submit claims and still get paid a week earlier than the last of the month. So I also wanted to mention if the providers, we're in finance, we are compiling a list of provider network billers. So if you could send your billers name and email address to payables@cmhcm.org, that would be really appreciated. That's all I wanted to add. Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you. I have a question in the chat. I'll be sending new amendments to reflect the changes. Absolutely. The amendment is in draft form right now. I hope to get that done. Our first and foremost priority is to get the rates changed in the system to allow for billing to open back up. And then as soon as we get those rates increased, we'll be working on getting that amendment out to all of you. It will specify in the minutes after today's meeting exactly everything that I have just said to you. And like I said, please be open-minded that this may change as we get further guidance from the state, hopefully not to the extent that this is, and we have to make changes like we are about to do, but just be open-minded about that. Another question. Tanya. Yes, go ahead, John.
So I apologize. I stepped out to take the MDHHS conference call, and the drug care codes added. They're putting some more on there, behavior tech codes, crisis res codes, SUD residential, and withdrawal management codes are new additions that will be listed in a new L, Medicaid L letter that's coming out either today or tomorrow. Okay, so I know that you alluded that there definitely are some that are being added on. There was a question whether supported employment was included. The answer is no. The whole intent behind the direct care worker premium pay is what they're calling it, is for in-home services. Okay, so just so that you understand some of the rationale behind the premium pay that's being offered. That means it doesn't include telework. So it's possible to have one code like in behavior where they're doing telework, but if they're not in person, it's possible that when the guidance comes out, it's going to differentiate on that. But they hadn't considered it until just 20 minutes ago. So that's how hot off the press is. A lot of these changes are happening constantly. There's rapid change. And we just certainly appreciate everyone's patience. They still are developing the guidance for better uniformity for the $2 an hour increase. They're still writing it right now. That's their status before they received the telework feedback. Also want to throw out, there was questions in times past about OT, PT, and SLP. And that policy has been released along with code charts. I just looked through my emails and I'm not spotting it. So I don't know that if it's hits other people's inboxes yet or not.
I received it this morning. Okay.
So that was a request a few times, and
we'll be sending that out after the meeting.
Okay. Awesome. So that is, the latest. If you're asking about the funding, where's this money coming from for the $2? They are trying to build it into those waivers that I was telling you about during my presentation. And they're having molded into all the different waivers based on the different funding sources that we get through Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And so they don't have it in any of them right now, but they're doing edits on the C waiver funding sources. So that's where they're trying to pull the money from, and then also building it into the other code or the other funding streams. Another update is AFC testing. They're trying to build an AFC testing system. It's quite complex. They're contracting out a tracing organization to assist in containing or controlling spread. They've come to the realization that the task, the project is quite complex. But I just wanted to put it out there that that's one of the things that they're looking at. They're also still investigating how to accomplish room and board costs for alternate locations, should there be a positive COVID-19 or a need to isolate. So those are the highlights. There's a lot of other things like meeting with Lara and trying to get everybody on the same page. Those are, I think, the highlights that I can share with you at this point. Thank you for letting me chime in, Tanya.
Okay, it wasn't letting me unmute, sorry. There is a question in the chat, and I know this has been a discussion amongst many providers and myself over the course of the last week or so since the First Amendment came out about the admin rate at 15%. It wasn't enough, and certainly the concern is at 12%, it isn't enough to cover your cost as well. Unfortunately, our hands are tied with that. I don't know if Brian or John want to jump in there and explain anything more, but that is the rate that's been passed from the state, and that is the guidance that we have to follow. The nursing code S9123, Kent asked if that is going to be a code that's approved. I don't know. We'll wait to get the final list from the state. Right now, it's not on the list. That doesn't mean that it won't be added. The OTPT speech codes, we just got the directive right before this meeting started this morning, so I'll be reading that over and sending a constant contact after this meeting in regards to what that allows or doesn't allow. And what happens if I've already billed? Is it just canceled out? Leanne?
If you've already billed and been paid, those claims will be reconsidered and you'll need to rebill. Peg and Carrie will be getting a hold of you to coordinate that. If you billed but have not been paid, your batch will be returned to you after this meeting so that you can correct the rates. And then once SIGMO has been updated, you'll be able to resubmit those batches.
Okay.
I would add, I just think that the 12 cents rationale is we want to be consistent across the state with from the governor and applying that, and so that's our rationale for matching to that on the 12 cents, or not 12 cents, 12%, 24 cents.
Okay. Question, self-determination arrangements will with the FIs in contact with the employers regarding the date change. Absolutely. The FIs will be handling this administratively, just like we did the first amendment. So they will be in contact with the SD participants. Any other questions in regards to the amendment? Like I said, the amendment that it will supersede the amendment that you were just that you just received and many of you have signed and returned will be forthcoming as soon as we have a chance to update the system to allow for billing. Any other questions? I just want to thank everybody for the presentations today. I think we had a very good meeting, a lot of substance to this meeting this morning, and a lot of useful information. So thank you for all the time that you put in. Also, thank you to the provider network for all that you're doing and you continue to do during this crisis. I think that we have proven time and time again over the course of the last several weeks that we're strong and we're strong together. And so I appreciate everything that everybody is doing to keep our consumers safe and keep our staff safe, and I just appreciate from the bottom of my heart everything that everybody's been doing to make that happen. So if there's nothing further, I will end the meeting and we will be in touch next time we have to have an update meeting regarding COVID, and we'll go forth. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Goodbye, everybody.